Hey, it's Matt. And I just got a lunatic. That's right. The best light El Spilio makes is now on my helmet. And I love it. And it is wasted on me. If you're a listener of this podcast, you know that between work and kids and life, caving is not exactly something that I'm able to do nearly as often as I would like. But I've been caving enough to know when a light like this is worth it. And let me tell you, if you're serious about caving, then you know that your light is one of, if not the most important pieces of gear that you bring with you. So you should have the best if you can help it, right? And this light and all of El Spilio's products are durable. They're easy to use. They are lights that are built for the rigors of the hardest caving on the planet. Now, if you're a serious caver who does it a lot, maybe you already have what you consider to be a good light, and that's great. But if you've ever wanted something better on your helmet, invest in the best. And this thing is the best, and it'll last. Go to elspilio.com and check it out. And if you want to buy, be sure to use the promo code PODCAST to save $20. elspilio.com, promo code PODCAST, and get you a lunatic or, you know, whatever else. Hi, it's Matt Pelser. This is the Caving Podcast. And this is a monthly podcast. I put it out on the first of every month. And it is a podcast where I interview cavers. What are cavers? Well, they're people who... Caving is essentially entering a cave. Going in a cave, moving through a cave, and it's something that we do for fun. And if that sounds like fun for you, and you're in the United States, we have a national organization called the NSS, the National Speleological Society. And there are local chapters or clubs known as grottos. And if you want to go caving, you got to find your local grotto so that you can find people you can go with. Because if you're new to caving, it is definitely, definitely, definitely. And even if you're not new to caving, it's not something you want to do by yourself. Now, there are going to be a couple of instances in this episode where we're going to talk about caving by yourself. But Martin is an experienced caver with decades of trips behind him. And he is going to talk about a couple examples where he was in the cave by himself, but not exactly, they weren't exactly situations that he wanted to have happen, but it was the best scenario for him at that time. But that is one of the rules that you want to follow. Don't ever go by yourself. The rule of three, at least four is preferred. That's in case somebody gets hurt. There's at least somebody who can stay behind with the hurt person while the other person runs to get help. And this is something that can happen. Caving is safe if you know what you're doing. It is decidedly unsafe if you don't. And there are a number of protocols: wear a helmet, three sources of light. I could get into all of it right now. But the best thing for you to do if you've never gone caving before is to get in touch with cavers. And they'll show you how to do it right. And they're really cool people. They're really nice people. But we are serious about the safety protocols. Because if you get lost and you don't come out, then we're the ones who got to go in and find you. And it's never good if we find you in bad shape. We don't want to see that. And you certainly don't want that to be the case. So get in touch with a grotto, make friends, and do it the right way. Okay, yeah, Martin Hoff, caver from the UK. I've heard about him. I've heard from him. We finally got a chance to talk. That's coming up. Of course, the past several episodes, I've been talking about the 2021 convention. Last month, we found out, of course, not last month, but in March, we found out that the 2021 convention will be virtual, to the disappointment of everyone who was organizing it. But those are the breaks, and that's what's happening. And you can go to the 2021 convention website in the description of this podcast, nss2021.caves.org. I've got a link up there, and we hope that you can make that virtual convention. Speaking of virtual presentations, Virtual Topics in Cave Rescue is a series being put on by the NSS, and I've been talking about this since February. Really, really cool. And in May is the last month for this series. In May, four presentations are happening. Two on May 12th, Search Operations in Cave Rescue. You have to find them before you can rescue them. And followed by Got Gas? Cognitive and Physical Effects of Bad Air in Caves. Fascinating topics. And then on May 26th, Stress Management for Rescuers, and rescue pre-planning, how to avoid or minimize the pain. So, virtual topics in Cave Rescue, this is the final month for this, and I will put the registration link in the description of this podcast, because you've got to register before you can do it. It's free, and it's on the second and fourth Wednesday evenings in May. And those talks are then going to be recorded and made available on the NSS YouTube channel later if you can't make them live. And if you're thinking, well, I'm not really a rescue type person, that's irrelevant. I'm not really a rescue type person either, but I went to an OCR, which is just the weekend thing, you know, orientation to Cave Rescue. It's not nearly the week long or any number of other series that Cave Rescue people put on. What it does is it gives you an appreciation for what goes into a rescue. It makes you a better caver, because then you're like, wow, I don't want to get hurt, because all of these things have to happen in order to then get me out. So virtual topics in Cave Rescue, I encourage you to check it out. What's been going on with me? Oh my gosh. This past month, I had such an embarrassing moment trying to talk to the Dogwood City Grotto. If you are a member of the Dogwood City Grotto and you're in this meeting, I completely apologize, because, and I'll explain this to you too, and I feel like I just need to tell everybody. I was just about to do my grotto presentation about the podcast, and maybe you've seen it, maybe I've done it for your grotto. I love doing it, and if you'd like me to do it for yours, let me know. I was invited to talk to the Dogwood City Grotto, which is an incredible grotto. They put on the Tagfall Cave-In. And so I was really, really excited. And I got on, and I had some computer trouble. No big deal. All right. I restarted and tried a few things. And in the process of restarting and sort of in a panic, I clicked something that then corrupted my iTunes library. And now – and I've lost it. I mean, it's not completely gone. It's still there, but it's not organized in the way that I've had it organized for years. It is a corrupted, damaged file now. Not a huge deal, but it completely wrecked the presentation that I had prepared for that night. So I wasn't able to do it. I was on the call with the grotto, and I'm like fumbling and trying to figure this all out, and it just didn't work out. So if you're a member of the Dogwood City Grotto and you were there that night, I apologize. I apologize that night too, but in retrospect, I just want to apologize again. And I am so grateful that they are having me back to talk in June, and I will be there. I've already given a talk to the Windy City Grotto. I had one scheduled a couple weeks after the Dogwood City Grotto incident. And that one went well, because I rebuilt the playlist that I had prepared for the other presentation. And so it is there. It is ready to go. And Dogwood City, I'm ready for you, and I'm looking forward to it. Okay. And again, I apologize. What a mess that night. All right. I am so excited. I am going caving today, May 1st. It's going to be a really small trip. My sister is coming. I've taken her caving once. It didn't go great. But she told me that she wanted to go again. So I said, all right, well, let's do it. And I'm taking my cousin's daughter caving as well. We're going to Sullivan Cave in Indiana, my very first cave. So probably be a good first cave for her. She's 13 years old, and I think she's a caver. I think she's going to be a caver. I'll report back more next month if I remember to. And are you going to Speleo Fest Memorial Day weekend? If you are, you might see me there. Speleo Fest at the Lone Star Preserve in Kentucky. You can go to speleofest.com to register. And I have made arrangements with the family. There is an understanding that I would like to go and do that weekend. I'll be fully vaccinated by then. Not to get into all that, but, you know, hey, science. So I'm looking forward to getting the hell out of the house and doing something, preferably caving related. So Speleo Fest looks just perfect. So if you're going to Speleo Fest, I would, I'd love to see you there. Okay. Martin Hoff, caver from the UK, shared some great stories, including one of as I mentioned, a casual solo exit on a long day trip, the circumstances of which he will share. All right. Here's a wonderful talk. Martin, I had such a great time. Me and Martin Hoff. Where do you typically go? I mean, you've been all over, mostly Europe, of course, but you've been in a lot of places. But you're going to Wales often, like if you're just going for the weekend, right?
Yeah, it's just at the weekend, apart from now where the world has all gone to shit and nobody can travel anywhere.
What would you say your go-to is there in Wales?
That's one of two things. That's Ogofen and the OFD, the initials you'll prefer to have a go at yourself.
I actually appreciate the actual pronunciation because I love hearing Welsh names actually pronounced, and they look nothing like they do if you were to say them phonetically how they're written.
For sure. But I also have a number of project caves that are in the same locality.
Yeah?
So if you'd clicked on the link to the SWCC homepage, you would see that we have what I think you call a field house, which is right above the cave.
Yeah.
So that's really convenient, and it means lots of people get very lazy, and they don't go very far, because you've got the cave just outside the door, and it actually goes right under the building as well. We have previously talked about drilling a great big hole in the floor to make it even easier for lazy people.
So that building will have a hell of a basement then.
Right. But, yeah, there are plenty of other bits of caving around there. So I tend to go about an hour's walk away from the nearest road. And I've spent a lot of time project caving, so digging and so on there.
Is there still a lot? I mean, yeah, when it comes to in cave, I'm sure there's still a lot to find when you go to sort of the frontiers of the known caves. But is there still a lot to find on the surface or new holes opening up? Have you walked it extensively enough, would you say, the area?
It's harder and harder one.
Yeah?
But, you know, the easy stuff's gone. But geology is a process, not a condition.
Yeah.
And in the river valley where I've been doing a lot of digging recently, the geology has been very mobile in the last few years. So there are new collapses opening up. So you walk along the surface and suddenly there's a crater in front of you where there wasn't before. And whatever's falling from the surface is going into space somewhere. And if you go up there when there's a lot of rain, that mountain swallows a lot of water.
Yeah.
That water's going somewhere. And it may be not in my generation or the next generation or the generation after that. But if we get enough water to keep going in there, it will open up enough that, yeah, eventually there will be cave that is human-sized.
What is the caving like in that area, would you say? I mean, I don't know if you can compare it to elsewhere in the world, but what are you dealing with a lot of?
The first thing to understand is that caving in South Wales is predominantly horizontal. So you can get a lot of caving done without having any vertical skills. As an organization, it hampers us a bit.
Yeah?
Because we don't have the skills to go, you know, if you lived in Tag, I gather that if you haven't got the vertical skills, you're not going caving.
Yeah.
Whereas we can do a lot of caving without having vertical skills. So it's a challenge to keep those skills up.
Does that help in a way, though, in that you've got people who are in that you might have more people who can do it? Because, you know, the vertical, as you know, wigs some people out and they don't want to do it. But they'll go horizontal caving and, you know, it takes less gear to go horizontal caving. Do you have more interest that you find then?
I think it goes both ways.
Yeah.
If you want to do the cutting edge stuff, then you're going to need the vertical skills. But then the last trip that I did, which was on Sunday, I was caving with a guy who's 63 and a guy who's 74 and just had his knee rebuilt.
Ooh.
And we could do that in a horizontal cave. But saying that, a couple of days before that, I did a purely vertical trip. And I did that same vertical trip in August with the guy who had just turned 75. So you need to pick your company.
Where was that trip?
And that is the only true vertical trip that we've got in that area of South Wales.
Okay, so you're there. Okay. And yeah. What are the several drops, one big drop?
It's about five altogether.
Okay. And what are we talking here meter-wise?
100 meters or so.
each one?
So it's not epic.
Total?
No, total.
Okay.
So it's not epic by any means, but at the same time, you know, it's not nothing.
How did you get started?
I started off from the Scout movement. If you want to know where I come from, anybody who knows the Scout movement would know that in 1907, Baden-Powell had the very first Scout camp. And where that is, that's very close to where I come from originally in England. But I grew up in scouting, so I spent a lot of time camping, tying knots, lighting fires, all that fun, fresh hour, fresh air, cold, miserable in the rain stuff. And at some point in the later period of me with scouting, I got introduced to rock climbing. At university, I had the opportunity to get involved with rock climbing, but there was also a caving club. And that's how I got into caving. I was already interested in climbing. After a couple of caving trips, I was hooked on caving, and the climbing went by the wayside.
Aha. Okay. Well, then that's a lot of people's trajectory, it seems. Caving just kind of takes over, right?
Yeah. What I found was I got on with caving from the very first trip when I was there in the cave. The first bit in the darkness, okay, I don't really know what this is, but I feel comfortable with this. I don't have a problem with this. And then as time went on, I found out that actually I got on with it quite well. So on my first caving trip, there were 16 people in the party, which is a lot of people to go running
That's
around
a slow
in a big
day.
Cave.
Yeah.
That's right. And we weren't going anywhere that was particularly serious. But an hour into my first caving trip, we were climbing down a steel cable ladder. And because I was already familiar with ropes, I was belaying people as they were climbing down the ladder. So I ended up falling into responsibility quite quickly. The story you want to get to
okay.
is, I'm going to try and keep this as fluid as I can. And we'll see how this goes. It needn't be a very long story, but it's nice and dramatic, and it's the sort of thing that when you talk to people about caving, it's the sort of thing they have in mind. Yeah, I did my first couple of caving trips, which were mostly horizontal, and the caving club had access to a climbing wall where one evening a week we would go and practice our rope skills. And I'd only done three or four of these practice events before we went off to go and do our first proper vertical cave. Now, on this trip, we were a party of nine. There were five experienced cavers. Two people, it was their first caving trip at all. And there was another guy who'd done a couple of trips more than me, and then there was me. And this is my third caving trip. So we took an hour of walking up onto the hillsides to where this cave entrance was, and we dropped down the first rope and the second rope, and there's a little bit of horizontal progress, then there's more rope, and there's a point where there's a little hole to duck through. And the next rope work, you step over the top of a stream canyon, and then there's a short rope traverse, and then there's the next drops which follow that. And the first guy went down the next drop, and he got to the next bolt where he was going to do the rigging. And then the next guy started going down the ropes, and now there are two of us on this traverse line. And we're looking down at the people rigging below us, and all of a sudden, there's this almighty rumble. And tons of rock went falling down the shaft.
Oh my God. What happened?
And from above, what we could see, because we're looking down on what's happening, we could see the guy's light, and we saw him go with all the falling rock, and we saw his light bounce once, and we saw his light bounce again, and then we couldn't see his light anymore. And it's one of those moments where it only happens in a very short number of seconds, but it feels like a lot longer.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it turned out that the shape of that pitch was like the letter J. So it goes down but then it bends forwards at the bottom. So he'd bounced, but he'd bounced forward under a ceiling. And then we had a certain level of shock and awe going on. And the second guy went down to see what was going on with this guy and find out what the nature of his injuries were, because it was certain that he would be injured. And the other two of us then turned around and went back into the small chamber where everybody else was. At this point, two people hightail it out of the cave, and everybody's reacting in slightly different ways. Clearly, this is a very dramatic, exciting moment. These are people I've only known for a month. I don't have the same level of emotional attachment that some of them have to each other. And for what we could do, the best thing that most of us could do, not having any skills to get involved with helping in any way, was to get out of the cave and get out of the way.
Yeah.
So four or five of us, we went back up the ropes, and I was the first one back onto the surface. This is a November day. It's now 7 o'clock in the evening. There's snow all around on the ground. The stars are out. It's a beautiful, peaceful, quiet evening. And I've got the whole of the hillside to myself. And I'm very cold. And I stand there for a little while, and other people start coming up towards getting out of the cave. And I see a pair of headlights coming across the hill. And then I hear the sound of an engine. And a short time later, there were two Land Rovers had turned up from Cave Rescue.
Oh, boy.
And then the next thing you know, there's a frenzy of activity. There are bags full of rope coming out the back of these vehicles. There are people going backwards and forwards. There's all sorts going on. And although clearly it wasn't a fun day out, it wasn't a good news event, I'm standing there and I've never considered the idea of rescue. And I'm thinking, wow, this is fantastic. Where have all these people come from? This wasn't by arrangement. They've just turned up out of nowhere. And that was one of the things where I first realized that I was probably going to stick with caving rather than be put off by that kind of thing. The summary of that story, so the guy had surfed down on several tons of rocks on the fifth pitch, and he'd ended up with both the bones in his lower leg, the tibia and fibula, broken. So it was a long time to get him back up five pitches and out to the surface. So after a short while, we were put into the vehicle and we were driven off the hill. And the people who knew what they were doing got on with doing what they knew how to do. And a little while later, there was an Air Force helicopter landed on the hillside to carry the casualty off the hill down to meet an ambulance on the road. And he was taken off to hospital. And although it was never going to be a good news story, for someone who'd never considered cave rescue at all before, it was an incredibly impressive experience, because I wasn't suffering from what was going on. I was just standing there watching and taking it all in. So the two people who were on that caving trip who'd never been caving before, I don't think they ever went caving again.
Oh, boy.
And the guy with the leg, it took a long time to get his leg healed properly. And that made a big dent in that year's caving activities, because we only had a certain number of people who could drive. And that sort of event kind of takes out some of the enthusiasm and puts people off. But for me, that worked out possibly for the better in hindsight, because it meant every time there was a caving trip, I was still keen to go. So I didn't get to burn out my enthusiasm. I just kept going caving and kept going caving for every time there was a trip.
So did that then, you're into rescue, right? You're a rescue person. You've done it before.
I'm a member of my rescue team now. I have been for 25 years. Yeah.
So would you say that sort of whet your appetite for rescue? Because there are people who are sort of prone to wanting to be involved in rescue. And would you say you're one of those people? I mean, I know that there are some people who do it out of principle, but then there are some people who really get into it, the planning, the preparation, you know, teaching others and things like that.
No, I wouldn't say that it awakened a love for rescuing people in me.
Sure. No one ever wants it to happen, but people get into it, as you know.
No, it was more, I found out that there was a lot more to caving than I'd appreciated.
Sure, sure.
And I was impressed by it rather than shocked and scared away.
It is impressive when you see it happening, and you were right to do what you did and just get out of the way. But you know that now, just in hindsight.
Sure.
I'm sure that wasn't exactly the... you would feel, if you didn't know any better, like you needed to be there and do something. But as you know, being involved in cave rescue, that's really not what someone who doesn't know what they're doing should be doing.
No, that's the time to step back and let people who know what they're doing get on with it.
Exactly. So let's go through some of your more memorable trips. There's no shortage of amazing places, even just there in Wales, but you've been caving in Spain a lot and France as well.
Yeah, I've been underground in about a dozen countries altogether.
United States included?
No, I've never caved in the US.
Oh, okay.
But I directed you to a picture on the back of an edition of the NSS News.
Yeah.
If you want to be reminded of how small a world caving is. If you look at the August 2018 NSS News, on the back cover you'll see a picture by Josh Hydeman, which looks like it's a rail tunnel turned on its end. And if you look in that picture, you can see two cavers. There's one that's very visible. This is a guy in a red suit. And if you look just behind him, or beneath him, or above him, depending on how you're looking at the picture in the three dimensions of looking down a big shaft, you can see there's another tiny figure. And that tiny figure, who's 100 foot down the shaft, that is a previous guest of the podcast.
Oh, who?
That's Elliot Stahl.
Oh, he's been.
And the guy in the red suit, and the guy in the red suit. Hello, my name's Martin. Nice to meet you.
Well, you're also like a photo guy. Like you're the guy who's got photos and records of a lot that you have done, and you have done a lot. So people come to you, right, for records?
Sure. I take a lot of pictures because I treat cameras as truly disposable. I don't use a good expensive camera, but I know which cameras I can get on with underground. I know which ones I can make do what I want. And I'm buying them all up on eBay for about 40 or 50 bucks. So I've got a drawer full of them here. And every time I fill one with mud and it gets to the point where it won't work anymore, I've got another one waiting, ready to go.
How long does that take, typically? How much life do you get out of one?
They'll last a year or two.
Yeah.
It depends on the trips. You know, the ones that go in the more muddy caves, they tend not to survive as well.
Sure.
But I do all right. And they certainly don't owe me anything by the time I finish with them. And one of the things you get with that is you take pictures where other people wouldn't take pictures. And that's why I've got a whole load of records of project caving, dig sites, people neck deep in water and that sort of thing. Because if I trash that camera, well, that's kind of what I took it there for.
That's a good attitude, because there are a lot of people who will bring a lot of stuff and they'll have, you know, the different cases for everything, and they'll treat it like it's... they'll treat it with this reverence, and I'm just like, you're taking it caving. You can't take anything caving and treat it with reverence. You can't be too careful, because then you'll move like molasses.
For sure. And that's as true of cameras as it is for all the rest of your caving gear.
Yeah.
Your caving gear is for being trashed. That's what you get it for, is so that you can wear through it and throw it away.
Some of these places, like a lot of the places in Mexico that people talk about here in the States going to, the pronunciations are borderline impossible for me.
Sure.
You've got some ones here that I have seen, and I'm a reader. I mean, I'm on the radio, but I'm more of a reader than a talker. And so I've seen these names. I've seen these names, and these are really significant caves. Let's see. Wow. There's an 82-kilometer cave that spans France and Spain.
Yeah, that's one of three caves I've been in where the cave crosses an international border.
Yeah, and is it known in the cave where that happens? Is it marked there?
Roughly, it's not marked, but it's roughly evident from the survey and from looking at the surface. So yeah, you can go in that cave in the Pyrenees, and if you do a through trip, you will start off in France and you will end up leaving the cave in France, but you'll be in Spain for a 10 or 15 minutes of your caving trip, depending on what speed you're traveling.
But, so the other entrance is in France, but you cross into Spain and then back. Okay.
That's right. It does a loop in under Spain and comes back across the border. Now, I've also been in a cave in Hungary, and you get to a certain point and there's a fork. And if you go right, you come out still in Hungary. And if you go left, you come out in Slovakia.
Did you do both?
No, I stayed in Hungary for the whole time.
Any particular reason? Was that just your goal, your objective?
That was the trip we were doing. We were there as guests of some other people, and they said, we'll take you on a trip. And we did the trip that they took us on.
But that one that spans France and Spain, you did that through trip, and you got a little chilly.
Yeah, the first time I did that trip in the mid-90s, there's a feature two-thirds of the way through, and the translation of its name is the Wind's Tunnel. Now, by the time you reach this point, you've spent hours wading in waist-deep water. The temperature's around 5 degrees centigrade, which is about 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, chilly.
And you're not going to be warm.
No.
Now, to cross this lake feature, the first time I went there, we were using inflatable boats. And I got in the bigger boat, and my mate got in behind me. But as I got in, the boat started moving. So we were never fully stable in the boat.
Oh.
And as the ceiling gets lower and the draft gets stronger and your carbide light blows out, so you're reaching to turn on the electric, and you see the end of the lake in sight, and you're hoping, are you going to make it, as the boat starts getting more unstable. And as we were moving along, the front of the boat was riding higher out of the water, and my mate was slowly slipping off the back of the boat.
Oh.
And we got to the furthest end of the lake, and he stepped off the back of the boat onto rocks in waist-deep water, and I watched the front of the boat rise up between my legs, and to each action there was an equal and opposite reaction. So as the boat went up to the ceiling, I became qualified to tell you the water there was 7 foot deep.
Oh, my gosh. Were you over your head? Did you go over your head?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. In 40-degree water. 40 degree Fahrenheit. Well,
40 degree air, for sure.
Yeah.
And the water's cooler than that.
Oh, gosh. And at that point, how much more time did you have to spend in there?
I think we were still in the cave for another 3 or 4 hours after that.
Oof.
But one of the great things about that cave, it's not a place you go to see pretty formations or decorated places, but you go there to see the scale of chambers. There are a lot of big cave passages, big chambers, which are maybe a couple of hundred meters long. And you need to be careful that you don't leave people behind. Because on that same trip where I'd come out of the boat, some of us got separated from a pair who were at the back.
Ooh.
And they'd walked down one side of this enormous chamber, and they hadn't realized that they crossed over to the other side, and they were walking back upstream up the other side. So they did a big lap of this chamber while we were stood waiting for them, wondering what the hell was going on.
Oh,
so
no.
that's a rookie error that you'd be less likely to make in an area with LEDs. But on that trip, you know, we were using carbide. What we could see was significantly less.
Yeah. This was the cave we're talking about is Pierre Saint Martin.
That's right. So the trip where I came unstuck out of the boat was in the mid-90s. But I was back there a few years ago, and with LEDs, it looks like a very different place.
Really?
And to give you an idea of how serious you can take that water, and also the capability of some cavers, I repeated the same trip that I'd done all those years before. There were four of us, and the other people, I'm sure they won't mind me saying, this is two guys aged 67 and one who had just turned 72. And we got to the watery point, and this time we weren't using boats. We were using big tire tubes, and that meant that you were definitely getting wet, just in a more controlled way. Now, one member of the party got very cold, and we ended up in a much more serious situation than we had done when I'd come out of the boat. But this is where a little bit of presence of mind and a little bit of knowing your stuff helps. So he wasn't moving very well. He wasn't moving very fast. But if he'd stopped, he was probably staying there until somebody else came and got him out. So one of the other guys just carried on moving down the cave with him at a very slow pace. And the other two of us turned on a stove. We boiled up a pint of water. We put it in a plastic bottle, and then we caught up with him, stuck a plastic bottle full of hot water down the chest of his suit. And just by putting a little bit of external warmth in that way, an hour later, he was good to go, and he was moving as well as the rest of us.
Oh, yeah, just warm up the core. Great idea.
But yeah, that's about making smart decisions at the time when you need to, rather than panicking or, you know, doing anything else.
When it came to comparing, I guess, that first trip when you fell out of the boat and the second trip, I mean, what were the differences in gear that would have otherwise kept you warmer? I mean, were there like no wetsuits on the first trip and wetsuits on the more recent one, or how did you do it?
No, on both trips, we were wearing broadly the same clothes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There wasn't a lot of difference with that. The thing that really made the difference is just having LED lighting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now it means that you can walk across the big chamber, mm-hmm. and you can stand there at the other end and shine your light back and blind your friends, and they know exactly where they're heading for.
Yeah.
Instead of going, well, there's a great big black space in front of us. What direction are we aiming for? So you can do that more directly.
So another trip in Spain, was it Red del Silencio?
Yeah, the Red del Silencio is a great trip, and I recommend it to everybody. But I don't recommend that you do it the way that I did it on my last trip in there.
This is a through trip. All right, what'd you do?
Yeah, this is a through trip, which is about 8 miles long, I think.
Wow, okay.
You start off on a ridgeline, and you look out across the valley, and you can see, this is quite a broad valley, and you can see a ridgeline beyond it. And then some clever person reminds you that you're going to come out beyond the further ridgeline. It's really quite a long way.
Wow.
So you start off with a couple of hundred meters of vertical. You've got a load of, let's say, a dozen or so pitches. You've got a 15 and then a 20 and an 18. And these are all in meters. And so you basically go rope to rope to rope. And you get off the rope a couple of hundred meters lower. And you are following a feeder system. This is a stream inlet that's going down to join another cave, which has got water coming in from other directions. And it's a fantastic fun cave. One of the great things about it is the character changes repeatedly. So you'll get a couple of hours of splashing around in a nice clear river, and then you'll get a couple of hours of stooping, crawling, walking along, and it's got a nice range of variety. And you come down and you meet the major streamway, and you follow that for a bit, then you go up to a higher level, and you bypass some bits which can sump in very high water, and you keep going, and you keep going, and you go a very long way. And the last time I was there, you get about two-thirds of the way through the trip, and you come down the last little bits of rope. There are a couple of nuisance drops. They are 8 meters and 5 meters. They're really nothing. And once you've done that, you can take off your vertical gear, and then you're at least a little bit more comfortable walking down the passage. You don't have all that metalwork clanking around. Now, when I got there, I was in need of relieving the pressure on my bladder.
Okay.
And it's a nice big dry sandy passage, and you really don't want to be going in that. But I knew that further down the passage, not a long way away, there is a stream that comes in, and you can dilute your pollution rather than leave it somewhere where it's dry.
There you go.
Where it's going to be a nuisance for everybody for all time. And I said to my companions, I'm just going down to the next water. And that was the last we saw of each other in the cave.
What?
That's right. I was in a hurry. I had pressing business to attend to.
Sure.
And I reached the point where I could hear drops of water falling from the ceiling down a side passage. And I went down this side passage and I went and took care of business. And at a brief moment, I heard a voice that I knew. And this was the other three members of the party passing the end of that passage. Now, one of those individuals has got an awful lot to say for himself. And I've been listening to his voice in caves for a very long time. And I knew for sure that was his voice. And it wasn't a whole word. It was just a fraction of a sound, but identifiable. And I thought, well, I better not let them get too far and wait for me. I better hurry after them. So I rejoined the main passage of the cave. And I know that if you get a little bit further down the cave, there is a waterfall that comes in through the roof. So even if they hadn't known that I'd gone down this side passage to where the water was, because somebody was talking too loudly to hear the water up this side passage, they would come to where this water was coming in from the roof and they would know we'd had that conversation. I was going to the water. Now, at this point, they're in front of me and they get to the water and they find that I'm not there. And for reasons best known to themselves, they decided that I must have hurried on out of the cave. And at this point, there's still a fair amount of caving to be done. The total distance from this point to where you emerge into daylight is probably another 2.5 miles, another 4 kilometers.
Wow.
And I figured out fairly quickly that they must be ahead of me. And I thought, maybe I can catch up with them if I race after them. And it only took me a couple of minutes to figure out that wasn't going to work. And of course, they thought they were chasing me. So they were getting a move on as well.
Oh, my gosh.
But it crossed my mind, as well as this side passage, there is one other side passage that they could possibly have gone down. And I wanted to be certain that it wasn't me leaving them behind. So I did think, should I go back and check this other side passage? I retraced my steps a bit, because if you lose someone, that's a sensible move. Go back to where you last saw them. They could have done that, and I wanted to rule that out. And no, there was no sign of them anywhere. And obviously, by this point, knowing what I know now, I was never going to see them again. So I took my time leaving the cave. I was perfectly happy. It's a thing that people are not advised to go solo caving. It's something you'll find lots of advice saying, don't go caving on your own. But what I would say, sometime you might find that you need to be solo caving.
Sure, sure.
And if that sort of time is the first time of solo caving, that might be more exciting than you want. So if you're going to go to some of these places and do these more exciting things, maybe being comfortable with solo caving is possibly something you want to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I always say never go by yourself at the top of the show, because it's one of those things where it's like, okay, when you do it for long enough, you realize you can, but you really have to have done it so many times and have been in that environment so often to really know. Because it's not like, you know, it's not this rule written in stone. It's this rule that we tell newbies. It's like, no, don't do it. It's a bad idea. But if you've done it as often as you have, and you didn't want to find yourself in that situation, it was just the necessity of it that made you do it. And you've had to do it before as well.
Yeah, that's right. And to cut a long story short, I spent 6 hours covering 2.5 miles of cave passage on my own. I stopped and got out the camera at one point and took some more pictures. And it crossed my mind that if I'm another half an hour late, that will give them another half an hour to think about what they've done. And I got very close to leaving the cave and I started hearing noises. And it was three of my friends who'd come in to look for me.
Oh, man, and they were behind you.
No. This is another three people who had come in, because the group that I'd been in the cave with, they kept thinking, oh, we know the way that the cave changes character. Maybe he'll stop at the next bit where the crawling starts. maybe he'll be stopped at the next bit where the river starts. And when they got to the water and they found that I wasn't there waiting for them, they had all their hopes set on, he'll be waiting for us at the car. And they came out to the car, and at that point they'd done an 11-hour caving trip. They weren't coming back for me.
Oh.
So they made a few phone calls and set a whole load of other people to worrying about what had happened. And generally when something happens, you've got some information. But in this case, all you've got is four people went into a cave and only three have come out. So eventually, three different people came in looking for me, and they found me about 10 minutes caving inside the entrance. So it was about right. It was enough to justify them putting their caving gear on. It wasn't so much that they needed to do hours and hours of sweating. They didn't have to go very far. And obviously I just walked out with them and there wasn't a problem for them to deal with. So that all worked out fine.
Did you catch any flack for, I mean, you did all you could. You tried to find them. You used every tool at your disposal to try to get back with them. I mean, what else were you to do, I guess?
Well, the kicker in this story is about knowing the information and knowing about the cave and knowing about where you were.
Yeah.
And of the four people that started out that caving trip, only one of them had been in the cave before. And only one of them had a copy of the survey. And only one of them had a descriptive set of notes of all the route directions. And that's the person you're talking to. So I was good. I was very happy. I knew the cave. I knew where I was going. And they were just charging off blindly to come out the other end. And it's a fairly straightforward linear cave. They were going to come out the other end.
Yeah.
But I was pretty relaxed. And I went back in there a couple of days later with somebody else to take someone to the point where we had all become separated. And, that person was kind of surprised how far we traveled. And when we got to the point at which I said, well, this is the last place I saw them, offered the qualified opinion, this is a f*** of a long way. might want to bleep that out. You might want to cut that entirely. That's entirely up to you. There you go.
There was another memorable solo exit in Spain that I've heard about.
Well, yeah. That trip in the Red del Silencio, I'd run together two different caving trips. So I was spending 2 weeks caving in Cantabria with my caving club. But before that, I'd spent 2 weeks caving in the Picos de Europa, which is a slightly bigger mountain range just further west along the northern Spanish coast. So coming out of the Red del Silencio on my own was nothing special, because a couple of weeks before, I'd come out from Pozo del Chitu on my own from the camp at 550 meters. Now, that was a considered decision at the time. I'd gone in there to go to the bottom. It was one of those tick-the-box things. And I'd come back up to the camp. I'd spent a night in camp, and everybody else that was still in the camp was either about to go to the bottom, or they had other projects to go and explore, other side passages or other things to do. And if you want to get a feel for how comfortable I was in that camp, I'd slept in the inner part of a three-person tent, but I'd been one of six people sleeping inside it. So there wasn't a lot of room to move around. And once someone gets uncomfortable and wants to turn over, everybody else is turning over. It wasn't a lot of fun. So staying in that camp for another 24 hours to go out with somebody, well, I wasn't getting drier. I wasn't getting warmer. I was only eating the food supplies that were in the cave to no exploratory benefit. And it was the sensible thing. So I had a leisurely 8 hours of leaving the cave on my own. Now, from the camp, you've only got 10 or 15 minutes caving, and you're going up the Flatiron Shaft, which is about 140 meters.
Wow.
So by the time you start getting halfway up those ropes, you already decided for sure whether you think that you're going to complete that trip out or not. But it was a nice leisurely trip. And for 7.5 hours, I didn't see anybody else, and I met another couple of people who were coming into the cave about 5 ropes down from the entrance. So I had a lovely leisurely day on my own, and having that sort of experience recently, before my so-called friends ran off and left me, meant that I was better prepared for a solo exit somewhere else than I might have been.
Oh, man. You've been caving in Germany as well, and there's a cave there called, how do you pronounce it?
Riesending.
Riesending. Riesending. Okay. I took several years of German, and but that doesn't matter because that's a proper noun. And but anyway, what was that one like?
Yeah, Riesending is a cave that became famous across Europe for a rescue that happened in 2014. It was one of the most labor-intensive rescues I think there's ever been, and someone was very seriously injured at a place around 1,000 meters down.
Oof.
And they spent something like 10 days removing him from the cave. There were rescue teams from 5 different nationalities that were in there, all part of it. And that's how I first heard about the cave. And as we've previously discussed, that sounds interesting. I wonder if I can get a trip in there.
Okay.
No, it turned out that a friend of mine was ahead of me on that, and it came up in conversation that he was going there, and I asked if he wanted company to go along with him. And this is someone who's very happy with the way that I take photos. Cave photography does not always have a good reputation for being a slick and quick operation. So he was happy to have me along taking pictures because he knows I get on with it.
Good for you, too.
And so this was then arranged, and yeah, I went off to go and see Riesending. And because of the rescue, it's a place which it has become much harder to get into. There are only a couple of trips a year now. The entrance is fully locked, bolted, barred, shut. You're not going in there by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You're only going in there with permission. So I was quite lucky to get on a trip in there. Now, because of the circumstances of the rescue, a lot of people who had been going there frequently before then found themselves put off or otherwise prevented from going there or discouraged by partners and so on, which means it's now slightly easier to get in there because you have to really want to go in there, and not many people do. And is now, I think there are 6 British cavers who have been in there, and it's a long day out. So you start off on the top of the mountain and you walk across to where the entrance is, and someone produces the key and opens up the cage door, and you're pretty much straight onto a rope. You can more or less touch the cage when you first get onto that rope. Now, when you next get off a rope, you're most of 1,000 feet lower than when you first got on the rope.
Wow.
So you go down the first handful of pitches and you come out on this balcony ledge, and you're at the top of a feature which has got the imaginatively given name, the 180-meter shaft.
That's a long way and not very creative, yes.
And I was at the back of the party, and everybody else was one by one getting onto this next rope down, and they were complaining that they were finding it really hard to move down the rope. And what appears to have happened is, at the time of the rescue, bearing in mind that on this trip I was in there only 3 years after the rescue, and we were still cleaning out a lot of the junk and so on, this was a rope that had gone in for the rescue, and unlike normal practice, this was a fresh rope straight off the reel.
Wow, okay.
So its shrinking took place while it was rigged in place.
Oh, no.
So this rope was taut to the one re-belay roughly half the way down. And I'm listening to people complain, thinking, yeah, get on with it. What are you complaining about? And then I get onto the rope, and then I find out what they're complaining about. Now, I abseil using a petzl stop, and you can use a carabiner to lock the handle out, so you can turn it into a straightforward abseiling device without the auto lock function. And I found that to get myself moving down the rope, I had to lock out the auto lock function, and then I was grabbing the rope beneath me and pulling it up to feed it through the stop to get me to start moving in the first place. Now, once I'd got 20 or 30 meters down, there's enough tension on the rope above. Now I've created a bit of slack beneath me, and now we start to run a bit more. But again, hanging 180 meters off the deck, disabling what you know is the auto safety mechanism of your descending device and hauling hard on the rope. That may not be everybody's idea of fun.
So was there something then when the first person, or I guess when everybody got to the bottom, that you were able to do then to make that a better experience later for someone else?
Yeah. The rope has subsequently been changed. It's a lot better now.
Okay.
But the good thing about the 180 meter shaft is that there is an alternative route that's rigged on the other wall. So you go down in two legs of abseiling or rappelling. So you're doing 100 and an 80 or something like that. But when you come back up, it's rigged in 14 legs. So you're doing 15 meters and then 18 meters and 10 meters and 23 meters. And that means that two of you can be moving at a distance that's only 20 meters apart, rather than wait for someone to prosic the full 100 meters before you can get on that rope. So it's a lot more practical that way.
I mean, is that how you ascend? Is it are you literally talking prusiks?
No, we talk about prusik as in the ascent of the rope using we will call them jammers.
Okay, so prusik is the verb in this case. Okay, gotcha.
I'm impressed it's taken us this long to come across a difference in terminology.
Well, there's plenty of different terms for sure, but that's the first one I guess I had a question about. Isn't that funny? I mean, we're all essentially doing the same thing, but I mean, now most of the people that you cave with, are they all using bobbins or petzel stops, things like that? Because that's, to me, it seems like the biggest difference in European versus American. And obviously the bobbins were developed in Europe and the rack was developed in the United States. So that's probably a lot of the reason. But is that your experience as well?
Yes, I think you're right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason for that is in the Alpine style rigging, which involves a lot of rebelays and a lot of deviations, there's a certain amount of technical moving around. And it's a different thing to take a great big rope, tie it to the back of your truck, throw it down a very deep hole and just keep going.
Yeah.
So more reasoning then.
Yeah, sure.
So then from the bottom of the 180 meter shaft, you carry on and there's a little bit of horizontal progress, but mostly you're on the ropes. And when you get off the ropes, you get to the camp, which is at 900 meters. And that's quite a morning when you wake up in that camp and you know that all you're going to do is have your breakfast, pack your bag, and then spend the rest of the day prusiking, there's that word again, up 900 meters of ropes to get out. That can be a long day. But there are further camps further up the cave. And I've been in there twice. The last time I was there, I ended up further up the cave in Camp 6 as well, which was a lot of fun. There's still more exploration going on there. And if you get to the far end of Reasonding, that's another one of these caves that crosses international borders. Because although the cave's in Germany, the furthest points of the caves are under Austria. So there's another border crossing there to be done.
Do you know anything about the potential? It seems like quite a bit of an effort to get to the frontier there, but they're still exploring.
There is still exploration to be done. You've basically got your 900 meter vertical, and then you end up in a horizontal level, which stretches for kilometer after kilometer. And to go in there now to be pushing the stuff, you're looking at trips which are over a week. So that, and to give you an idea of how long the last trip I was in there for, I went into the cave at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning, And I came out at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening.
Wow. Impressive. That sounds like a lot of fun, though. I mean, 900 meters of climbing is nothing to sneeze at, but I mean, gosh, to get down that far, that's incredible. That's got to be an atypical vertical extent for that area, or are there a lot of deep caves there?
That's certainly the deepest cave in Germany.
Yeah.
And in that block of limestone, there must be potential for more deeper caves. There's another similarly extensive system over the other side of the hill. But yeah, that's about what the extent is. They seem to reach the water table, so it's not going to get much deeper. But yeah, it's a hell of a place, and I think it's great, and I'm planning on going back if I can.
Ah, yeah. Be one of those two trips a year. Now, podcasts are audio only, which is the medium I choose to work in. But we are seeing each other on video call right now. You're wearing a shirt that says "Make SWCC Cave Again," which I can only assume is a reference to American politics. And SWCC, of course, stands for
South Wales Caving Club.
All right. So you keep it simple and just it's Caving Club there. Here we have grottos. And one of the big caves that you have explored with SWCC is Ogafunindi. Did I get it right?
Close. Oh. You weren't far off.
Okay. You say it.
It's Ogafunindi.
The, okay.
It means the cave of the Black Spring.
Okay.
So it was first entered in 1946, and SWCC has spent a lot of time there since. And now we have a cottage which is directly above the cave. Now, one of the things that is a feature of the cottage is that on one big wall of one of the bigger rooms is the survey of the whole cave system. And this thing is several meters long. And the exercise of resurveying it was fairly recently completed, but it lasted over a good number of years. And there's a trip I want to tell you about from the latter period of that cave being surveyed.
Okay.
So there are four people in the caving party, and two of the other three were also in the three that left me in a cave in Spain. these are people I've known and caved with for a long time.
Okay.
And they were setting off on what was going to be a 12-hour surveying trip to tie up a few loose ends at the furthest end of the cave. And we head off into the cave, and we've all been going in there for decades. We know where we're going. We're making good time. And to get to the furthest point where the surveying is going to start, you're still looking at two and a half hours. And at the furthest point, you join a streamway. There's a little bit of wading in waist-deep water. You climb out of that water up onto a ledge, and then we were going to climb up the wall to go into one of the higher-level side passages, which is where we were going to do some surveying. Now, the first guy climbs up this wall and gets to the top. And then the second guy goes to start climbing up this wall, which is really just a loose pile of sand and blocks, and it's not incredibly stable. And to start the climb, there are only two really good holds that you want to start with. So the right foot goes up onto a hold that's about knee height off the ground, and then your left hand is going way over to the left. So you're already in a big diagonal stretch before you stand up on your right leg and then move on further up the climb. And when this happened, the chap in question grabbed the hold with his left hand, and that block peeled out of the wall.
Oh, no.
And because he's already at an angle, he spins backwards, and now he's rotating in the air. He bounces down and hits the ledge. The first time he hits his head, his helmet goes flying.
Oh, no.
Then he hits his head again and disappears over the side of the ledge. So two of us are there, and I go back down the way that I'd come up, which is the longer way. The other guy more or less jumped after the guy who'd fallen. And the second impact of his unprotected head on the rock had knocked him out cold. and he'd landed unconscious, face down in a foot and a half of water.
Oof.
So the first guy gets him and grabs him round the waist and lifts him up and pulls him out of the water. And in so doing, he injures his back. And by this point, I'm down there, so I'm taking what we can now call a casualty off the guy holding him, and I move him a little way down the passage. But remember, this is a streamway. This has got water flowing along the floor, the length of it. So I move him to somewhere where the water's a bit shallower. Your standard recovery position, lying face down, isn't going to work here. And I've got him on his side. I'm supporting his head and keeping his neck extended so his airway's clear. And after a couple of minutes, there's a little bit of coughing and spluttering and bubbles coming out of his mouth. And then he sits up. So it's one of the few stories I can say things started looking up when he started breathing again. And what followed after that is an incredible piece of self-rescue,
I would say.
And again, this is the value of experience. All of us, we'd been going in that cave a very long time. We knew exactly where we were. And then you do a calculation. One of us could run for it. It's going to be at least 2 hours to get out. Then it's going to be time to get people together. It's going to be at least 2 hours to get back in. You're talking a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And with the urgency of trying to get out, you know, you'd be on a mission doing that. There's every chance that you might have your own problem on the way out. It's not necessarily the smart move to go running off for help and weakening further a party that's now got one proper casualty, one part casualty, and the one first aider. So after a little bit of sitting around, we found that there were a few flesh wounds, but the first thing that we could do is see if we could start moving back down the stream. And he was walking all right, and we just walked nice and slowly along the stream. And at that point, you keep going, and then you get to somewhere where you can get out of the water. And we've already achieved something. So if at this point it all starts going downhill, well, we've removed what's now a casualty from a very cold, wet weight into a cold, drier weight. And there are a few more obstacles in front of us. There are a number of places where there are exposed traverses. So you're stepping out across a big drop, holding on to not very much. And as luck would have it, there was one person in that party, again, someone you're talking to, who had a short length of rope. So we could stick him on a short belay and secure him up a number of climbs and various more exposed places. So the trip that had taken us 2 and a bit hours to get to the point where that happened, we spent something like 6 hours having a leisurely, self-powered self-rescue. And that is the virtue of knowing the cave and knowing each other and not making rush decisions and running off for help when you don't need to. But when we got back, we were nowhere near overdue because we'd only been underground for 8 or 9 hours and everybody thought we'd be gone for 12. So it was just a bit of a surprise that we were back early, that was all. Until people started looking at the blood in various places and so on and so on. But if you want to know something about the caver who was the casualty in that story, his conclusion when we'd got him back out was he was disappointed that he'd wasted a good surveying day without getting any legs surveyed.
Now, when you say that, are you talking, you're talking about the back injury or the head injury person?
The head injury.
Okay. All right. Now, what was the extent then after the fact? Were there, did anybody need to get treatment?
Yeah, the back injury was basically aggravating a long-standing thing, but the head injury, it's one of those things you don't plan for it.
No.
But the way that it went was about as well as it could have gone. So because he was rolling horizontally, he landed fully face down with all parts of him. And if he'd gone head first and landed, then obviously the neck takes the impact. If he's gone feet first, the ankles take the impact. So the way that it worked out was about as well as it could have done.
Wow.
And there were a number of flesh wounds. There was scalp laceration that needed gluing up. There were a few more bits of loose skin all over. So instead of having one single highly damaging impact, it was a shared set of impacts all over the body. And all of them were relatively minor. You spread the impact out that way.
Wow. Got lucky.
You know, you can have different degrees of unconscious.
Sure.
You know, you could be just out, or you could be really heavily out. And in this case, he was really heavily out.
Wow.
But with three people that he'd been caving with for decades alongside him, he pretty much walked on autopilot. He couldn't tell you much about the trip. You know, it's a mechanical motion. You put one foot in front of the other, and that's all it took.
Wow. So finally, Martin, I want to know what's still on your list. Where do you want to go? I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of places, but what is your reasonable next big goal?
Well, this last year has been a bust, frankly. Nobody's going anywhere. Nobody's traveling anywhere. So just to get moving at all, I'm booked on a trip to France this summer. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it won't. I definitely plan to get back to Riesending in Germany again. And to go back to that picture we were talking about.
Yeah.
That was a picture taken on one of Bill Steele's trips to Wautla in Mexico. And I'd love to go there again.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. It's a very well-run expedition. There's plenty more to be done. And I'd like to spend more time caving with cavers from North America.
I found that
would be great. Yeah, and you never know. I might turn up in Indiana sometime.
That would be marvelous. We've got some cool caves, perhaps nothing like you've seen before there in Europe and down there in Mexico, of course. But we got some really good stuff here. And, of course, you know, if you come to the United States, a trip to Tag is always going to be a good one.
Yeah, that's also on my list. You never know.
Well, Martin, I really appreciate your time. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope you get to go back to Riesending.
I'm aiming to.
All right, you take care, okay?
Well, thank you for having me on, Matt.
Man, what a talk. Martin Hoff from the UK, international guest number 3 on the podcast. How cool was that? Martin, thank you so much. And thank you for listening. This is a monthly podcast. The next episode is out on June the 1st. Who's it going to be? I don't know yet. It's exciting. It's always exciting when I'm working one episode at a time. But I don't know. It's kind of fun that way. Support this podcast by supporting our sponsors, past and present. Of course, we're sponsored by El Spelio. Get a light at elspelio.com. Get the best caving light you can get. And save $20 by using the promo code podcast, elspelio.com, or click the link in the description and get the light that I've got, the Lunatic. It is amazing. And of course, we've also been sponsored by Swego in the past. Get a pack at swegogear.com and Organic Robot Designs. Hit up the Etsy shop, search for Organic Robot. Or, of course, he's got the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana, or Google Organic Robot Designs. If your grotto needs t-shirts made, Charlie will hook you up. He deals in all kinds of fabrics. He does screen printing. He does vinyl transfers, things like that. Whatever you need, Charlie's got you. All right, am I forgetting anything? I don't think so. Happy caving. And until next time, kill nothing but time.